Herzlich willkommen zu Mein Element, dem Podcast vom Lützebäuer Journal und Zusammenarbeit mit dem Fonds National de la Recherche.
So, how many professors are women? How many directors or deans of faculties and universities and research institutes are women? I hope people have not given up on the protection of what's most intimate and important and valuable to them. I think that most of us do not realize the extent to which we are surveilled. Honestly, I don't believe my papers are super cited and I don't care.
Mein Name ist Max und normalerweise freue ich mich auch bei Mein Element immer, wie sie dann ihren Job andere Leute gegen erklären. Für den Gast von dieser Episode habe ich mir aber etwas anderes aufhalten gelassen. Ich frage Dariana Rossi nämlich, ob wem hat Leverwelt in Ovent ihr zu gehen. Mom Elon Musk, Mutter US-Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez oder Mom Edward Snowden.
Oh my gosh. So I think Elon Musk is a douchebag, so I don't think you would really enjoy dinner with him, because I think he's going to be all about himself. However, it would be super cool, I imagine. However, if I really had to choose, I think I would rather spend a great evening with Ocasio-Cortez.
Okay.
Really. And really talk about what is her vision and what we should do together. And I think she's a very inspirational congresswoman. So.
Ich muss sagen, ich habe den nämlichen Schwa getroffen und vielleicht habe ich auch schon kombiniert, was die drei fiktiv Dinner-Dates dann gemeinsam haben. Richtig, so ein Allgäu-Apps mit Datenschutz zu dienen. Der Musk gehört schließlich Twitter, dem Snowden verdanken wir das Wissen über die Existenz von der NSA und Ocasio-Cortez. Ja, das hat der Facebook-Gründer Mark Zuckerberg so richtig an die Schwäße gebracht.
Did anyone on your leadership team know about Cambridge Analytica prior to the initial report by The Guardian on December 11th, 2015?
Congresswoman, I believe so, and that some folks were tracking it internally.
And
I'm actually, as you're asking this, I do think I was aware of Cambridge Analytica as an entity earlier. Mm-hmm. I don't know if I was tracking how they were using Facebook specifically.
When was the issue discussed with your board member, Peter Thiel?
Congresswoman, I don't know that often.
You don't know? This was the largest data scandal with respect to your company that had catastrophic impacts on the 2016 election. You don't know?
Well, Congresswoman, I'm sure we discussed it after it after we were aware of what happened.
Okay.
Dariana furcht also mit seiner Equipe ganz simpel Ruf gebracht am Bereich vom Datenschutz. Mehr so ganz einfach ist es dann aber nicht, weil das Thema eben direkt mit Mayfelder touchiert. Und sonst kennst du Schiedrin aus dem Team mit Informatik, Computer Science, Droit und noch viel, viel mehr aus. Und weil Schiedrin so viele Disziplinen gleichzeitig beherrscht, kann ich auch mal ein Geräusch freuen, als Schiedrin aus seinem Team ein Genie.
We are. Yeah, I can put this on paper. No. But I think, honestly, what I think is very cool, and I think it's also one of the next or one of the skills that we really need to acquire as researchers into 21st century is collaboration. So let's go away from this idea that we have of the genius in a ivory tower somewhere that thinks and reads and reflects a lot and has this kind of very long, intense brainstorming sessions with himself or herself. But usually we have a man in mind, of course. But let's go away from that. I'm not saying that this does not exist and I'm not saying that this is not needed. Actually, I think we all need to like read much less emails and do much less interactions to really reflect about what we can do. And we really need that kind of space, mental space to have ideas and really reflect and develop and elaborate. However, I think that we also need to collaborate much more. This is why, so first of all, you need to be able to speak with people that are coming from a completely different backgrounds. So even the lexicon to refer to the same phenomenon, to the same concept or to the same problem is different. And when I mean something by using a certain word, it doesn't mean that the person in front of me coming from a different experience means the same thing. And in what we work, we see this a lot. So a need for a common lexicon is needed, and especially between computer science and law. But it's not only this, it's also like a set of skills of how do you collaborate with people. And we've seen this also with the pandemics, right? So a lot of new collaborative tools are coming up. However, are we really able to use them in an effective way? And how do we collaborate? What does it mean? So like there are a lot of like, I think they're called soft skills about this, in which you need, I don't know, to negotiate or to organize meetings, to be efficient, to negotiate, to organize the work of others. So this is what we do. So we try really to have, we do have actually a lot of collaborations with other research groups at the university, but also in other research institutes in Luxembourg and abroad. So this is what we do. We try to really get the most out of, I would say, a crowdsourced research knowledge and expertise. And I think this is really key for the researcher in this century. So to put together all of this, because you cannot do this alone. It's impossible to understand certain complex phenomena, like the one that we're going to probably speak about. It's impossible if you don't put together all these different perspectives. You cannot solve the privacy issue if you do not solve the technical issue, the legal issue, how people actually use technologies, economic issues, because we're speaking about this. So if you don't put all of this together, you understand just a part of the problem, you will not solve it.
Datenschutz, das ist das größte Thema von unserer Zeit. Und als Digital Native haben wir euch ganz lieb, wie ihr uns schon im Internet verbrüht. Und wahrscheinlich kennen euch diese Datenzentren und Algorithmen besser, wie wir euch wollen bewusst sind. Aber wir sind uns eins. Das Ganze ist gar nicht so geil. Eigentlich müssen wir ja Politik hoffen, dass die mehr Bescheid wissen.
Das Internet ist für uns alle Neuland.
Ah ja, da war es. Melo Mozayö, wen springt dafür alles an? Müssen das dann jung Politikerinnen und Politiker sind? Oder wäre auch das egal, für das wir bereit sind, aus Daten freiwillig mal rauszugehen?
Oh my gosh, you raised so many important points there. I think there are so many reasons for that. Yes, I'm not sure whether it's policymakers from other generations. I would say that not even our generation is able, unless you really work in the area and you know all of this and you touched with your hands all of this. I don't think it's super easy to grasp or to be aware of all of this knowledge that exists. So first of all, you should have this kind of training probably also in other domains and domains that are really about human behavior. I think it's very important for policymaking. And most people, of course, do not come from that area. If they have a training, if they have some kind of educational level. This is one thing. Second thing is also, I don't think, as mentioned earlier, that as researchers, we are able to always or efficiently get what we find, our results, to the right people, in the right moment, in the right form. Also, how do you communicate results? So the fact is that, I mean, unless those knowledge that is already kind of established, and it's the knowledge you would teach to, a first-year-old bachelor, there is so much contrasting results in many things, in many phenomena, that you cannot just say, oh, this is like this, or this works like that. Right. So we just made an experiment, for example, in which we were really seeing whether a certain technique, so a certain way of saying things, can influence whether people accept app privacy permissions or not. For example, whether they give access to their geolocation or not. And because it is assumed, so there is a lot of assumptions also, and this is the same for the, you know, we inform people, they are aware. They are empowered. They can go out in the world. This is a kind of a cultural assumption that we all share, which we really need to get rid of. And it's very difficult. And it's the same for certain things. There are certain assumptions about, oh, this specific linguistic technique, for example, influences people in certain ways. And this is an assumption. It's now written in official guidelines. And what we found in our study, for example, is that, well, it is not the case. In our study, we found other studies in which it is not the case. We found other studies in which it is the case. So what I'm trying to say is that there is also a lot of contrasting evidence. And how do you summarize that? With a lot of nuances. But you cannot get for every single phenomenon, right? What is the simple answer? There is no simple answer. There is a complex answer with all the nuances, and you need to be an expert to understand them. And if you're looking for a yes or no answer, I will not be able to give it to you. So indeed, I understand why it's difficult, right, to have this dialogue. So I think there is a lot, and I hope people have not given up on the protection of what's most intimate and important and valuable to them. I think that most of us, do not realize the extent to which we are surveilled, both by public bodies and private bodies, organizations, companies, etc., for reasons that are mainly to give away our most intimate sphere for advertising purposes or for state surveillance purposes. This is the problem, is that we don't know about that, and not even experts understand the extent to which certain data practices are privacy invasive. Because maybe, for example, if you don't work, for example, I don't know so much about state surveillance. If you work with people working with police organizations, etc., or people at the borders control, they're going to tell you stuff that happens, that is happening, that is, you're going to be completely shocked. If you work with people, I don't know, working in industrial practice, I don't know, genetic companies, what they actually do with your genetic data, which is the most intimate thing you could ever have about yourself, you would be completely shocked. And we don't know. We ignore. So I don't think people gave up. I think people are really unaware. And this is why, but raising awareness is important, but is just one of the many steps that we should do as researchers and society, because I think much bigger or harder or like stronger protection is needed, because this surveillance is so around you all over that you cannot do much as an individual to shield yourself or to protect yourself. It's not enough. It's not going to be enough. And it's not fair. It's like saying everybody's doing whatever with the environment, right? And but you as an individual, you're the only person that need to protect yourself from the risks of pollution. No, it's unfair. That's not how it works.
Okay. Which apps do you use where you know that the terms and conditions are not that great and you still, however, chose to use them?
Oh my gosh.
And have you read the terms and conditions, or did you or did you just press accept like everybody else?
Well, of course, I just downloaded it. Sometimes what happens to me is that I do read privacy policies, but I think it's really a thing that privacy nerds maybe do sometimes. And only when you have doubts and you start, oh, but I wonder whether they send data to the US and I wonder what kind of security measures they implement. Huh? But it's rare. As I mentioned before, there are other drivers of behavior, even for people that are privacy pro. For example, everybody uses WhatsApp. I don't know. In France, it's a bit different. Everybody uses Messenger, which basically is the same. But everybody uses it. Everybody. You know, like, I don't know, whatever it is, even professional relationships, that's the channel through which, at least today in Luxembourg or in Europe, all the communication goes through. So can you really say, I'm not going to use it? No. Maybe what you can say, try to nudge the people that you know and say, hey, you know, I'm also using this privacy-friendly app. By the way, just for the record, there are those apps. One of them is Signal. One of them is Element, which is, you know, just to tell you. One of them is Telegram. So you can tell to your friends or maybe to your loved one, maybe all the super intimate conversations that you have with the loved people of your family or your partner or your kids or whatever, maybe they don't deserve all of this, all the pictures, everything, all the emotions and feelings that you share. Maybe they don't need to be somewhere, you don't know where, you don't know how used. It's usually used for advertisement purposes, right? So you can try, but at the end of the day, if most people are using that, that's what you're going to use. So do we really have a power of choice? Not so much. There is, in technology as many other things, we just adopt what most people are using because it's more user-friendly and it's easier to use.
Dariana kennt ursprünglich nicht aus Lützeburg. Auch von hat schon, wenn sein Job ein Zeitchen heu lief, aber eigentlich was hat er aus Italien. Gelieft hat zum Beispiel zu Bologna, der älteste Universitätsstadt in Europa, und gleichzeitig der Heimisch von der Tortellini. Ich bin gespannt, was hat dann zur Stadt zu erzählen hat, weil auf den ersten Blick klingt es so, wie wenn das meine nächste Vakanzendestination wäre.
You lived in Bologna.
Yep. You were stalking me. You see what I see about surveillance? No.
Also, you get a notification on LinkedIn if I visit the profile. So.
Oh, really? No, this, because I don't have LinkedIn premium. So they just tell you, hey, somebody visited your profile. If you want to know who, get the premium experience. Anyway.
So you lived in Bologna. How was it growing up there?
So I didn't grow up in Bologna.
Okay.
So Bologna was my alma mater, so my university. My mother is from Bologna, so my blood is half Bolognese, not Ragù Bolognese, like from Bologna, and half of it is Tuscan, but I feel maybe more Tuscan. But spending the university time there was the most amazing experience you can ever believe. I mean, you will never find anybody that tells you, oh, I didn't like my university years in Bologna. That's impossible. Everybody loves Bologna. And by the way, if you are listening and you're thinking about an Erasmus somewhere, or maybe your kids want to go to do a period abroad, think about Bologna, because it's an incredible place where like 1/4 of the population is young people, students of the university, or is somehow related to the university. It's a beautiful historical medieval city. It has that kind of unique light, really the light of the sun with combined with the colors of the buildings, and there is even a specific color which is the Bologna red, which is very very typical from there. So the light and the colors make it possible that the light that is there is incredible. There is a lot to do. It's in the center of Italy. Very good, by the way, welfare state, welfare region, so to say. I think the main means of transportation is the bike, because it's very flat. And it's super enriching from all the different cultural points of view, but also if you want to have fun. And the university is great. And is, well, by the way, maybe you know, but it's probably the oldest university in the world, because it was founded in the 1088. So in a few years or a few dozens of years, it's going to have 1,000 years. So I could not possibly say anything negative about Bologna, I think. So great, great experience.
Apropos Bologna. Gerade konnte ich von ihm den Vorwurf, dass er schon zu viel im Internet gestalkt hat. Wobei, eigentlich war eine Recherche. Aber bei der Recherche habe ich etwas Witziges gefunden. Nämlich ein kleiner Schatz. Ein Interview von ihm, den hat damals über die Verkehrssituation zu Bologna für internationale Studenten gemacht. Und wie die klingt, das hört ihr daheim.
Hello, this is Arianna Rossi and I'm a student of an international PhD program. This interview is part of an assignment for the Coursera course called Human-Centered Design and Introduction. So, off we go with the main part of the interview. Rohan, please, could you tell me some information about yourself, like your name, your age, your current job?
Where did you find this?
On SoundCloud. On your profile on SoundCloud.
On SoundCloud.
Google page 7 or something like that.
Wow. Okay, that was like a capstone project I did for a course that I was taking online on UX. So it was, yeah, it was mostly like an interview. So it was like kind of how do you do interviews, qualitative data about a specific topic. Ah. Oh my gosh. Interesting. You see?
Everything stays on the internet.
But at the moment when you started to like making me listen to it, I was like, what is that? Okay. Wow.
And I found out that you like to listen to music. For example, you like reggae, but not any form of reggae. You like roots reggae.
It was on SoundCloud or on YouTube. You cannot say, but you should.
Or even on Twitter.
it could be. Yeah. On many profiles. Well, I'm really passionate about music, actually. So roots music, roots reggae music is mostly, let's say, the roots in the sense that comes from the origin, so to say. 60s, 70s especially. So there was one of the golden moment for reggae. And most people do not know so much about reggae apart from Bob Marley, probably, which is a pity, because in the 70s especially, but even nowadays, there are thousands and thousands of artists which created incredible rhythms. But I think it's still perceived as a very niche kind of music style, so not so many people know about that. But then, of course, there is also the more modern part in which is dub music. It's a kind of digital, so to say, evolution of reggae nowadays. And France is one of the most important countries, actually.
Okay.
In which there is a lot of production, a lot of concerts, a lot of sound systems. So, yeah, I'm not sure whether that's really related to my job or whether I use that ever. Sometimes, because I think, you know, like actually your musical taste could reveal a lot about yourself, about your political views, about your philosophical views, about your religious views. If you are a Rastafari, I mean, if you listen to reggae, you could be Rastafari, which is a religion, which is sensitive data. Or maybe you'll have certain political inclinations, huh? Rather than others. It's very revealing.
Where we see that everything is, again, connected, like you said.
Everything reveals a lot about yourself, even things that we don't know about. So, but then if you write it on Twitter, then maybe, yes, I understand it's quite public. I should review a few profiles now that you made me aware of what I Google. Maybe everybody should like Google themselves.
You never Google yourself?
I never Google myself.
Even though that you publish so much stuff, don't you want to know who uses the things that you publish?
Well, you can use Google Scholar, but I never look at the rankings. Honestly, I don't believe my papers are super cited and I don't care.
Wie man Ariane über den Fall schwätzt, die merkt, das hat man im ganzen Herzblut dabei aus. Er erklärt Sachen präzise, mir aber ob anhecht. Und dabei ein extrem open other voice. Und brennt sogar so viel für sein Thema, das hat sich auch nur Feuerofen Domoder beschäftigt. Dafür hat nämlich Legal Hackers Luxemburg gegründet. Me, für wart euch lösch?
Ja. I still wonder. Put me in this banana. I'm joking. So, Legal Hackers is a global movement. It's a global grassroots movement. It means that we are not, necessarily organized in a legal entity or association, something like that. So we are the Luxembourg chapter. And what is very cool about this global community is that it was born 11 years ago, out of the need, so to say, to put together people that are passionate about law and are passionate about technology and try to build bridges across those two communities. And also the fact of being hackers, so being makers, not only speak about things, but also try to solve pressing issues of society, for example. And as we mentioned before, there is a lot, privacy is one of them, but if we're speaking about society, law, ethics, and technologies, almost everything nowadays is at that edge. So there are a lot of challenges, a lot of issues, a lot of opportunities there. It is so cool to be part of a global community. When we have our yearly global meetup online, you see people from all over the world, the five continents, really. Of course, many more in Europe and North America. So there is still an imbalance there. But it's you're like, wow. I'm really part of a global community. We are all volunteers. That's also, you know, nobody, actually one of the main rules of the code of conduct that we have, it's a ethical stance, so to say, is you don't do it for your own profit. You do it really because you want to share the knowledge that maybe you have because you're an expert with others. So it's really for the general public. Then it really depends on the topic that you, so we organize events. Just let me finish with the... So we do organize events. Events are for free. They're open to anybody. And we try to represent different views. So not only certain interests. My idea when I found... So when I was in the US, actually, I met at this conference the main founder of Legal Hackers of the world, Jameson. He's a great guy. And he told me, yeah, you know, but you work in this. Why don't you found your own chapter in Luxembourg, right? I was like, I don't know. And then as soon as I finished my PhD, I was like, yeah, let's do this. And it was great to see also how not so many, I would have expected much more participation, but some people were super passionate about that and then started this journey with me. Many of them have left for many reasons. I think it's not easy to be a volunteer. It takes time. You need to solve a lot of issues that you have no clue how to solve, but you need to do that. And people expect stuff from you and things can go wrong in so many different ways. What we do organize events. Now with the pandemics, of course, as you may imagine, it was very hard. We tried to keep the community together because we also have this community. It's a core community, especially of people in Luxembourg and also some broader community of people that come and go and may come to an event and not to others. But we do also try to make knowledge in open access. So what I know is because I'm an expert and because I had the possibility to study, to spend time, I do this the whole day, of course I'm an expert, right? But most people do not. We also try to make different sectors of society meet. For example, certain of our events, we had people from the Parliament of Luxembourg, or people working from academia, of course, but also big companies, startups, the governments, other associations. And it's great to put together all these things. So also something that is great about being part of Legal Hackers is that I know everybody in Luxembourg, honestly. It's wonderful. I know exactly where to look for if I'm looking for someone expert in something or if I have an idea about something else. And now you see, especially after the pandemic, so I don't know if it's now that everything is kind of blossoming again, even if we have the threat of the war and a lot of other threats and that I think do not let us hope for the best. But I think I see a lot of people really want to feel engaged. People want to do something, not only work and spend their whole life working for someone else most of the time, okay, for someone else's wealth. People really want to be engaged, build things, discuss societal issues, try to find solutions, do, makers. And this is very cool. This is a change I saw. I don't know if it's me only, but I saw it in the last few events that we have been organizing in the last few months.
Stell dir mal einen Computerhacker vor. So einen richtigen, klassischen Hacker. Du bist ein Nerdy, die ganze Zeit am Computer tippend, mit Talent, sich an alle Systeme ranzuhacken. Hand aufs Herz, wen hat gerade einen Mann gedurcht? Ich gehe nicht so, ich auch. Und wenn ich an Filme denke, dann ist den Hacker oder den Computerprofi auch meistens ein Mann. Und im Bereich von Informatik scheint es ja auch schon normal zu sein, dass der Beruf bis auf wenig Ausnahmen von Männern ausgeliefert wird. Aber für was ist das so? Für was sind Frauen an Informatik eigentlich unterrepräsentiert?
Okay, I have 4 at least. I'm not an expert. So you should really ask the experts. For me, it's mostly like I saw things how they were here at S&T and I wanted to change them. And I saw how things are around and I want to change them. So first of all, it's a systemic issue. So everywhere, women are underrepresented. And it's not only in terms of percentages, it's really people that are decision makers, people that are in power. So how many professors are women? How many directors or deans of faculties and universities and research institutes are women? And then, of course, we could also go beyond women and speak about gender and about inclusion much more. But if we stay really stick to the women and men. So it's a systemic issue that is present all over the world in all sorts of different organizations, in all sorts of different levels of power. We are underrepresented. There is willingness to not have other people in charge. It's a design. It's a specifically designed, intentional reason for that. So we never have to forget that. Okay. There is culture change, something that you mentioned. So there are a lot of stereotypes around certain professions, for example, that we need to win over. And it is this kind, as we were mentioning before, this kind of mental image that you force. So a stereotypical image of a certain job or a certain, I don't know, Italian or whatever. So a certain person, no? So we need to win over also this kind of, biases and stereotypes that we have, for sure. There is the fact that it may also be, so also from the external, it is perceived as a male-oriented profession. Also for studying is the same. As mentioned, I didn't study computer science. So for me, it was quite the opposite. We're a lot of women. But then there is also the workplace conditions. For example, my group is quite balanced, actually. We have women, we have men, I have friends. I think we live a very happy life, at least under that point of view, right? Not all groups are like that. If you look around now that you're going to get out of the Maison du Nombre, you will see how many more men there are. Which I'm not saying is bad per se, but it can also be the case that they engender certain behaviors, which may be herd behaviors, and that they can reinforce themselves because you're in your echo, male echo chamber in which certain behaviors are okay. Honestly, it has not been the easiest experience to be always surrounded by men, not only here where I work, but also at conferences, for example. They have certain expectations about you. They have, you know, I don't know, sometimes I've been asked, oh, are you the secretary? Or are you? And then you're like, no, I'm a researcher like you, right? I mean, why would you assume that? And it's very hurting, you know? Or maybe they tell you something about your beauty or how you're dressed, right? And it's something you would never compliment. So they're perceived as compliments. But for you as a, right, as a professional, that's not a compliment. You want to be perceived for everything that you are, which is much more than your outlook or how you're dressed. So there is all of this, just to sum up. Sorry, I know I'm very verbose. So there is, of course, a systemic issue that we need to change. If we, then there is the stereotypes. So the culture, really, how this profession is perceived. There is also the workplace climate. I think it's called workplace climate, in which it means how do you like coming here every day and living what you live? And how well do you feel with your colleagues or with your boss? Because there can also be a lot of problems with your boss. And I think these are the main problems, I would say. And not necessarily the only ones.
Thank you very much for your time. I hope you enjoyed it, that the questions weren't too naive. Even though you weren't prepared or couldn't prepare because of me, the answers were very, very good. Thank you very much. And the last words are always for the guest.
Thank you so much for the invitation. I had a lot of fun. Honestly, so it was a great occasion also to not only to speak about science, but to speak about many different topics and challenges that are really interrelated in our society. I don't know how to end, so thank you so much and enjoy your day.
Mir verhallen Neues. Persönliche Daten sind extrem wertvoll und wir müssten mal ab und zu überdenken, wem wir die zur Verfügung stellen. Das war es von Mein Element. Wenn euch der Podcast gefallen hat, dann liked ganz gerne, teilt mit Freunden und Familie. Wir hören uns die nächste Woche. Bis dann. Ciao.